things.
Mm-hmm.
And it's getting to be kind of hard to get the assignments done.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like Thursday, my son's taking wrestling now.
Mm-hmm.
He wants me to go to that.
Mm-hmm.
Just a whole bunch of different things.
Well, there shouldn't be any problem to go out at, you know, at this point. And then, you know, I think they... You know, you have to get permission. They wanted you, but there's no problem as far as you've already had the first semester. And
they asked me to get permission.
Yeah, I would really encourage you if you possibly can to next semester hit it real hard so you can get your credit for it and so forth. But.
Well, even if, you know, if things don't work out, figure I'll just learn about osmosis.
Yeah, well, I get the more. Yeah, that's the more exposure. Yeah. Exposure. So good.
Then you go there and zone
something.
No. No, but I get more out of it, I think.
Yeah. We left off in chapter 17, so we're going to look at that again this morning and talk about this middle voice and the forms that are involved here. We're just about, with chapter 17 and 18, we're getting the bulk of the verb forms that we're going to have to be dealing with day in and day out. There will be other forms that will come, but those aren't nearly as important or widely used as the ones we're dealing with here. So, section 123 on page 99. We talked a bit about the middle voice idea and the way that English transmits that idea without a middle voice form. And so we're really dealing with fundamentally different idioms or different linguistic structure in Greek and English in this area. And this is where there are problems generally with the students really being able to grab a hold of this thing. But after you've used it and dealt with it for a while, you begin to get the sense of it, I think, just like anything else. Now, section 123, verbs like English, bathe are also found in Greek, but in Greek, the distinction between these and other verbs is paradigmatically marked. That is, they have special middle forms to indicate the middle meanings, which, as we have seen, must be indicated in English by syntactic context. Even in Greek, the middle voice is not complete, so to speak, since distinctively middle forms occur only in the aorist and future tenses. So your aorist and future are going to have, there'll be an aorist middle and an aorist passive. Two separate sets of forms. So you can clearly tell on the aorist whether you're looking at a middle or passive. It's not a matter of context, it's a matter of form. Also in the future, there's a future middle and a future passive, and they're clearly distinctive forms. But in the present and in the imperfect, the forms for the middle are the same as the forms for the passive, which is both good and bad. It's good in that you've got one less paradigm to learn. It's bad in that now you have to decide by context which is which. And there's a certain set of contexts in which there's no problem, and another set of contexts in which it could go either way. And the general rule that most follow in cases like that is if it's ambiguous and you don't know, it's more likely to be passive than it is to be middle, because middle is used less frequently. But we'll take a look at some examples here, and then when we look at the meanings and so forth, we'll talk more about that. Now, yes?
If they don't have an ending,
how do they know there is a middle? Because there are certain constructions, for example, where you see a form that looks like it's either a middle or passive, but you've got a direct object also.
Mm-hmm.
And in that case, it has to be middle. So from the fact that we see it used in cases where it has to be middle, there's no question about it from the context, then the cases where there's ambiguities, it could be either one. You'll see that in just a little bit when we look at the meanings here. Okay, in other tenses, the middle voice is formally identical with passive voice, so that we are again thrown back on syntactic considerations. In the illustrative sentences below, we introduce the aorist passive as well as the aorist middle to facilitate comparison and contrast. Note that the verb in each of these cases is luo, not luo. Luo omicron upsilon, not luo upsilon. Okay? So, which means to bathe, or to wash, so forth if it was active. Well, I guess to bathe, and you know, I guess they're translating it this way anyway. So, sentence A, hey adelphe elusen ton technon, to technon. The sister bathed the child. Now, this is an active form, and it's just an active aorist form like we've seen before. You just add the sigma to the base, add the augment, and add your epsilon nu ending here. The nu is optional, of course. So, we've seen this form already, and so there's nothing new here. But here we have an active verb. The sister is bathing the child. Sister is the subject, bathe is the active verb, and child is the direct object. Now sentence B, e adelphe elusato, this is the middle form, an aorist middle form. Now, the aorist middle, as we'll see, is going to be formed basically the same as the aorist active, except with a different set of endings. We have the augment, we have the sigma added to the base, but we have ato for the ending for third person. So the sister bathed is the way it's being translated. And the idea there, of course, is that the sister is bathing, or you might even say bathed herself, although we don't usually need to say that. And then sentence C, to technon eluthe hupo tes adelphes. Here's your classic passive structure with to technon, the accusative direct object, eluthe, what was formerly the direct object, excuse me, is now become the subject. And eluthe is a passive verb form. This is an aorist passive. And we haven't really looked at aorist passives yet, but you can see basically we've got a theta stuck in there and we've got an eta type ending. And we still have the augment. But the sister, the child was bathed by the sister. Then hupo, tes, adelphes, your pupo with a genitive showing your agent. So a few comments here in a summarization of the forms and diagram of them. The form elusen is first aorist active, described in lesson 15. The form elusato is first aorist middle, and the form eluthe is first aorist passive, as one might infer from the presence of hupo, tes, adelphes. Okay, the structure of sentence A is a noun in the nominative, verb in the active, and another noun in the accusative. And so your simple subject, verb, object construction. And in this case, the ex sub n is the subject, indicates the performer of the action. And sentence two, structure, or number two, the structure of sentence C, our passive construction, now he's jumping down to C, is y sub n, verb in the passive, plus hupo, plus the noun in the genitive. And we've already, this is just review from what we've seen before. In this case now, the noun is the receiver of the action, even though it's in the nominative case, and we have a passive verb form. Now, three, sentence structure of B is X sub N and verb in the middle, and the middle voice. So X sub N is now the subject, as indicated by the nominative case. In this structure, the subject indicates both the performer and the receiver of the action. In this particular sentence now. The subject is performing the action and the subject is also receiving the action. The subject is initiating the action of bathing and the subject is also receiving the action of bathing. This would be what we really call a reflexive sense, where you do something to yourself or someone does something to themselves, etc. So the indication of this reflexive meaning is only one of the functions of the middle voice. This isn't all there is to the middle voice. This is only one of those functions. We shall discuss this and other meanings later in this lesson, but for the present we shall turn our attention to the forms themselves. Okay, what about the forms? Well, it's just a matter of adding some different ending sets here and noticing what's happened. Section 124, forms of the first aorist middle are given below. To facilitate comparison and contrast, the forms of the first aorist active and first aorist passive are also given. Here we return to luo as our model verb. Good old luo, back in the home ground here now. Okay, first of all, the active voice, we've already seen this part. Elusa, elusas, elusen, elusamen, elusate, and elusan. And we've seen this before. First aorist is just a matter of adding the augment, adding sigma to the base, and then adding the alpha type endings. Now, the middle voice is exactly the same, but we have a different set of endings now to show the middle. Again, we have the augment, we have the sigma added to the base, and now we have eluso, elusato, elusamatha, elusaste, and elusanto. Now, if you examine that set of endings, you may see something familiar. At least I hope you will. If you remember your passive endings that we've already looked at in the previous chapter, in lesson 16, for the imperfect. In fact, I think you wrote your paradigm in your lesson. Maybe we didn't have the paradigm written out there. But if you look at page W69, on your on the ending systems that you've had, well, actually page W70 would be the closest set of endings to this. Your passive endings that were added to the imperfect forms, we had omein, u, eto, omatha, esta, onto. Now we've got amein, o, ato, amatha, asta, anto. So they're just the same endings, really, except with alpha as the first vowel. The only one you have to watch is that second person singular, which is vocalic. In the imperfect passive, it was omicron upsilon. In the aorist middle, it's omega. But otherwise, if you know those other endings, just take the omicron or epsilon off and put alpha in its place and you have it. So it facilitates easier memorization if you can notice those parallels. So amen, o, ato, amatha, astha, anto for the endings for the aorist middle. Now, one thing you have to be careful of, though, is that these endings with alpha are for the middle voice, not for the passive, whereas those endings we looked at before are for both middle and passive in the imperfect. We haven't talked about the fact that they're also for middle, but they are. In the imperfect and in the present, we have no distinction between middle and passive. And we'll delineate all that information in a grand paradigm here real soon. After we finish chapter 18, we're going to put the whole works on the board. And you can get it all down in one place. And I'll give you a little schemes for adjusting, you know, figuring out the endings. I wonder if I've got that. I can show you. No, I guess I don't have my color-coded one here right now. But you can use some color coding and things and set up a nice little paradigm diagram. Well, the only hard part is memorizing it. Okay? Now, the passive, aorist passive, is given beside that. And that's quite a bit different. We have eluthane, eluthase, eluthae, eluthamen, eluthata, and eluthason. Now, you can notice a common pattern to a degree. You have the augment, you have the base, present base, but instead of having a sigma added, we have a theta. And instead of having omicron or epsilon or alpha even on the endings, we have eta all the way through. In fact, there's a consistent eta all the way through this entire ending system. Ain, ace, a, amen, eta, asan. So they're not that bad as far as the actual endings are concerned, and really for the stem. But as you'll see, there's some complications with the aorist passive, just like there were with the others. There's first and second aorist passes, the first, second aorist middles, first, second aorist actives. And one unfortunate thing is that if a verb happens to be second aorist in the active and middle, it may not be second aorist in the passive. It may be first aorist in the passive, and it may be first aorist in the others and be second aorist in the passive. So you'll see what I mean in a minute. Okay. What was that? Amartano, yeah, it had both the first and second aorist, yeah. Grafo is one, for example, that's first aorist in the active and middle, and it's second aorist in the passive. But as it turns out, the second aorist passives aren't a whole lot different. They have the exact same ending system. It's just a matter that they don't get the theta. That's about all there is to it. So they're not too bad as far as the actual forms, and the endings are the same, and they're easy to recognize. In other words, an aorist passive is one of the easiest forms to recognize because of those eta endings. It's real easy to recognize, so that's one nice thing about an aorist passive. Okay. Look on the positive aspects as much as we can here. Now, section 125 just summarizes the endings of the first aorist middles we've already looked at. We have amen for the first person singular, o for the second person, ato for the third person, and then amatha, astha, anto for first, second, third person plurals. So again, it's not at all unlike the ending systems we learned before for the imperfect passive. Then these are added to the first aorist base of the verb found by dropping off of the third principal part. So again, the first aorist form of the verb is just the base. You know, the most general way to find the first aorist base is to take the third principal part and drop the alpha off. Why say it that way rather than just add sigma to the present base? Why word it this way? Anybody? Can anybody guess? In other words, why is he saying if you want to find the base, drop the alpha off the third principal part instead of saying just add sigma to the base? Yes, Mike.
Because the sigma changes the base sometimes.
Right. Well, because the sigma will change the base, and because, for example, you have those phonological changes where it's not a matter of just adding sigma; it's a matter of a phonological change. And there's also the irregular ones, the irregular first aorist. So even if it's first aorist, you still may have an irregular first aorist, and we had a few of those. So because of that, the most general way is to. That's why you have a third principal part, is because of those irregularities. So you look at the third principal part and chop off the alpha off that and put the endings on. Now, if it's a real nice regular verb like luo, all you have to do really is add the sigma and put the endings on and the augment. But the most general way, because there are irregularities and so forth, is to deal with the third principal part. Okay, so here we have five verbs here given, and the aorist passives, aorist middles given for those. Luo, we've already looked at. Elusa and elusamein is the first aorist middle. They're just using the first person singular forms now. Grapho, egrapsa, you get that phonological change by adding the sigma to psi, sigma to p, and that becomes, or to phi in this case, that becomes psi. And then the same phonological change takes place in the aorist middle, egrapsamein. Dioko becomes edioxa and becomes edioxamein, accent shifting, of course, because of the endings. Baptizo becomes ebaptisa with a sigma now because of the zeta, and then ebaptisamein. And alepho becomes alepsa. You get the eta because of the augment on an alpha, and the psi because of the sigma added to the phi. And then the same thing in the aorist middle, elapsamein. So basically, the aorist middle is going to do the same thing that the aorist active did, as far as its stem changes and so forth are concerned. In other words, the aorist middle is kind of a slave to the aorist active. Whatever the aorist active does, the aorist middle is going to do. If the aorist active is a second aorist, the aorist middle will be a second aorist. If the aorist active is a first aorist, the aorist middle will be a first aorist. If there's a phonological change in the aorist active, it'll be the same phonological change in the aorist middle. So those kind of go together. If you know about the active, all you need to know is the ending system, and you've got the aorist middle. So there's no real complication there. In other words, no additional complications to what we've had before. Okay, now the aorist passive, though, is a different kind of animal here. We've got some other considerations here. The aorist passive forms are not derived from any of the bases studied thus far. The first person singular aorist passive indicative is itself a principal part, the sixth principal part. We've kind of jumped to the sixth. The fourth and fifth have to do with the perfects and so forth, so we'll get to those later. But the sixth principal part is the aorist passive. And the reason they have to set it up as a sixth principal part is simply because there's no way to predict on the basis of other forms what it's going to be. In other words, you don't need a principal part if you can predict accurately what the forms will be from something else. But when you can't predict it from something else, then you need another principal part, and that's what's necessary for the aorist passive. When it is a part of a regular verb, it is formed by augmenting the present base, described in section 95, and by adding thane, theta, eta, nu. So if you want to find the sixth principal part on a regular verb, you just add the augment and add the theta, eta, nu. The aorist passive base is obtained by dropping eta, nu of this form. So basically, and you could have said that by just, if you want the base, just add a theta to it. But the reason they've said it this way is, again, because it will take into account some of the exceptions to the rule and when you get to second aorist and so forth, so it's making it a little bit more general. You see what I mean in a minute. So if we want to find what, for a regular verb now, like luo, we want the sixth principal part for the verb, we will add the augment and put the suffix theta, eta, nu on. If we want the base only, then we drop the eta, nu off, and we have just basically added a theta to it. And the ending systems for the aorist passive are as follows: eta, nu, eta, sigma, eta, eta, mu, epsilon, nu, eta, tau, epsilon, and eta, sigma, alpha, nu. Ain, ace, a, amen, eta, and ason. And those are somewhat like some of the endings we've had before, but not enough to avoid having to memorize this as a separate paradigm. Probably the quickest way to do it. Now, the manner of forming the aorist passive of regular verbs is illustrated below. So on page 102 here, we have a chart indicating for regular verbs what happens in the aorist passive. Now, you might be able to predict something, though, before we look at this. If we're going to be adding a theta onto the base, we may encounter some phonological problems, just like we encountered when we added sigma onto a base. And in fact, we do. And in fact, fortunately, the phonological problems we encounter are in precisely the same places that they were when we added sigma onto the base. So that will make it somewhat more reasonable. Pimpo, for example, the present base was pimp, And the augmented present base would be epimph, just adding the augment to it. And the aorist passive would be epimphthane, epimphthane. Now, we added our theta eight anew, just like we were told to do. But notice the P changed also to a phi before the theta was added on. So it's epimphthane. You get the phi-theta combination. That's somewhat similar to what we saw before when we added a sigma onto the P. Remember, it turned into psi. Now when we add the theta onto it, we get a phonological change also. I suppose the difference is that the theta doesn't go away. It's still there. But it does affect the letter before it. Look at kalupto. We have a P tau base, and that becomes ekalufthane, ekalufthane. So the same phonological change occurs with that as occurred with just a P. The P tau is now changed into a phi. Dioko becomes edioxthane, edioxthane. Now it's no longer a hard kappa, but it turns to a chi before the theta, edioxthane. And ago becomes echthane, echthane. Now the eta is there just because of the augment, but the gamma has also changed to a chi just before the theta. So it becomes echthane. These are fun to pronounce, a lot of these. Caruso, you get the double sigma. The double sigma also goes to chi before the theta. So, ekeruchthane. Now, a double sigma was one we saw before where we had some problem with. And here it becomes ekeruchthane, a little bit different change than we saw before, but nevertheless a change. Baptizo, the zeta, it becomes ebaptisthane. Ebaptisthane goes to sigma. That's what we've seen before. And alepho, anoint, you got the phi, that's just going to stay phi, alephthane. So don't have to worry about that one. Now, to summarize this in these phonological changes, section 127 has a chart that's, if you want to take a look back on page 74, you had was where that other chart was. And you'll see that we got a very similar type of situation. So if you want to compare those two, I think that would be wise. We find in part A, we have if the base ends in P, beta, phi, or P tau. That's the same four things we had before. P, beta, phi, or P tau. When we added a sigma to that, it became C. When we add the theta to this, it becomes phi theta. Phi theta. Then the second category was kappa, gamma, chi or double sigma. And that's the exact same ones we had over there on the other chart. Kappa, gamma, chi, or double sigma. Now before they all became chi. Here they all become chi theta. So you just get the softer sound there. And then the last group, delta, theta, or zeta, the so-called dental stems, they just became a sigma before, and here they become a sigma theta. So it's a similar type of thing. If you just think of those things becoming a sigma and then putting a theta on it, you've got the same thing. So if you just remember just a few things here, you can remember the phonological changes occur in the same position, same places, just a little different phonological changes off. So we'll try to cut down our memory load any way we can, and to notice these parallels will really help. Okay. Now, section 128 is where we run into problems. There is no way of telling, however, whether the aorist passive forms of consonant-based verbs, or even of all verbs whose bases end in vowels, will be regular. It is, therefore, generally necessary to memorize these forms, or to look them up in a lexicon. You can't really rely upon what's going to happen. A few of the more common verbs with irregular first aorist passive forms are given below. Now these are all irregular first aorist passives, and they've all got a theta. In other words, as you will see, the only difference between a first aorist passive and a second aorist passive is this theta. The second aorist passives don't have a theta, but they have the same ending system. With our active forms, the first aorist and the second aorist differed in the ending system. Usually, that there was a stem change and then they went back to the imperfect endings. Here we have the same ending system, but just no theta. And so let's look at our irregular first aorist first. These are irregular first aorist passives. Akuo becomes akusthane. Akusthane. What is irregular about that? Do you know what the irregularity is? Huh? Yeah, the sigma's in there. See, you wouldn't have predicted that. Like luo was just eluthane, and Here we have a sigma added onto our base before the theta. So that's irregular. You wouldn't have predicted that. Sozo, meaning to save, becomes esothane. Esothane, what's irregular about that? Yeah, the sigma's missing. Just the opposite. You see, the zeta you would have predicted to turn into a sigma before the theta. You still have a theta, but no, there's no sigma there. Heurisco, now this is actually a misprint, I think, from what I've seen. They've got urethane there, but you may elect to change this. In the chart in the back, they have urethane, an epsilon there in the middle instead of an eta. And we looked this up in the other lexicons and so forth, and urethane apparently doesn't occur in the Testament. So you may want to make a change there, because that's the one we'll go by, urethane. Just checking in the text and the lexicon and so forth, it doesn't appear to have the eta. See, it's an understandable mix-up sometimes, because there are sometimes where a verb will have a variant spelling. Sometimes it'll be with epsilon, sometimes with eta. There are some like that. And that may have been how this originated. Or it may be used with an eta in classical writings or something like that, but not in the New Testament. So for the New Testament, it's just urethane. That's an epsilon. It should be spelled epsilon, upsilon, rho, epsilon, theta, eta, nu. So go ahead and make that change and memorize it that way. If you look it up in the back of, in the that chart of principal parts, that's the way you'll see it. Let's see. Yeah, in it's bottom of page 330, so you'll see it there, and they don't give any optional form. And then I think we did some checking in the text and found it was only that way too. Okay, so with that minor change there, we see that again this is irregular in that we've got a sigma kappa there. And these are the ones, this one you could predict to be irregular, because the sigma kappa type of thing, you don't know what it's going to do. And what it does here is just drop out completely, and then you get a change in the vowel and so forth. So it's just a irregular, but it's still first aorist in that it has the theta. Yes, question?
What would be the active aorist in that? Do you have an idea?
Let's see, Heurisco, it was Huron, I believe is what we had. It was the active was a second aorist. And the passive is the first aorist. So Huron was the active. We went back to our imperfect endings, remember. Okay, didasko is edidachthe. Edidachthe. Now, again, the irregularity here is because we got sigma kappa again, and this time the sigma kappa became a chi. But we still have theta eta nu. Lambano, we have a nu there at the ending. Now, this one's quite irregular. Eleifthane. So it looks like we've got almost an entirely different stem there. And Lego, that's really what you call irregular. It's erethane or erethane. Here's one where it could be either with the epsilon or eta. So they give you both forms here, and both of them would be correct. Okay, so, but they're all first aorists because they all have a theta on them. Now, section 129, but they're irregular in that the phonological changes you expected and so forth aren't there. There's a stem change of some sort. Verbs which have second aorist active forms also have second aorist middle forms, but need not have second aorist passive forms. So that's something you need to remember, that there's not necessarily going to be a correspondence. If the middle will follow what the active does, but the passive forms will not necessarily follow what the active does. The active forms may be first aorist, and the passive forms may be second aorist. The active forms may be second aorist, like with Heurisco, and the first, and the passive forms may be first aorist. In other words, the first and second aorist pattern isn't consistent in the passive with the active and middle. But the middle will always follow what the active does. Now, similarly, verbs with first aorist active forms always have first aorist middle forms, but may or may not have first aorist passive forms. The forms of the second aorist middle are obtained by adding the following endings to the second aorist base, found by dropping omicron nu of the second aorist active. Now, we're looking now at second aorist middles. Second aorist middle is going to be basically the same philosophy as we've seen before for second aorist active. Now, what we do then for the second aorist middle is we take the base that we've had, and actually just take the second aorist active base. Remember, the second aorist active base had some sort of stem change plus the imperfect type endings. So what we do is take those imperfect type endings. off, and then we put the imperfect passive endings on. See, if you look at these endings, it's omen, u, eto, omata, este, onto. That's the pattern that you had earlier for the imperfect passive. Actually, imperfect middle and passive. So your second aorist middle is going to be following the same kind of philosophy as we saw with the active forms, only now we just use passive endings, and we use the imperfect ending. So second aorist middle is formed by taking the second aorist base, which involves some sort of stem change, and then using the imperfect endings, imperfect passive endings. Omen, u, eto, omata, esta, onto. Yes? Yeah, I said because they're the same endings for middle and passive. We haven't really stated that. He stated it, but he hasn't really in the paradigms. From now on, when we write our paradigms up, when we write those that set of endings, we'll call them imperfect middle and passive because they're used for both middle and passive. There's no way to tell the difference. So when I give you the grand paradigm here pretty soon, maybe next week, early next week, maybe we'll get to it this week. I don't know. Probably not. But we'll delineate all those shades of meaning and so forth. It's kind of hard with the textbook the way it's written like this. That's one weakness in this textbook. I think that he would be greatly improved if at the end of each chapter like this he would give a summarized paradigm, or at least at the end of the section give the whole paradigm for you. We'll supply that inadequacy in the class here, but it's really a weakness to his book in my opinion. But you know, I can see he's probably one that's trying to get away from simple rote memory. You know, he's given all this grammatical analysis and so forth, and he may have had an aversion to doing that. I don't know, but I think it would help in addition to everything else he's done to include those. If you really want to see how bad this verb gets, you know, if you've got Dana and Manti, there's a chart included there, a big fold-out chart, so forth. That's got the omega conjugation, which we're dealing with now, and then the me conjugation also, so you can see how many different verb forms there are. And if you really are masochistic, you can take a look at the Hebrew paradigm. The full Hebrew paradigm for a verb has something like, I can't remember if we counted them all, but something like 144 different forms, something of that order. Because you've got seven different conjugations, the call, the nifal, the hifbael, hifil, and so forth, kual, epl, and all these different types of derivations, changing in vowel points, and then you've got all the person's numbers in the perfect and imperfect, and quite a range of forms there too. So in Hebrew, yes, what's called the hifbael corresponds to it. It's got reflexive type. Usually it's used in the reflexive idea, but it's got sometimes a middle idea too. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Let's then the second aorist middle forms of Hurisco are given below, formed on the second aorist active of Huron. So Huron was the active form for the aorist, and it was a second aorist. You can tell that, of course, because of the endings and the stem change. Now, for the to make that middle, second aorist middle, all we do is drop off the omicron nu and put on a different set of endings. So we get huromain, huru, hureto, huromatha, huresta, and huronto. So just a matter of a different set of endings to take the second aorist active and make it a second aorist passive. Excuse me, second aorist middle. Now, second aorist passive, section 130. Second aorist passive is irregular in that no rules can be given for obtaining its forms for any particular verb, nor is it possible to predict in advance that a verb will have a second aorist passive rather than a first aorist passive. The first person singular of the second aorist passive, which ends in eta nu, but not in theta eta nu, must simply be learned as an irregular principal part. The second aorist passive base, like the first aorist passive base, is obtained by dropping eta nu of this part. The endings are the same as for the first aorist passive. Among the most frequently occurring verbs which have second aorist passive forms are the following. So there's no shortcut for this, really. You just have to know what the second, what the sixth principal part is for the verbs. And that's why he's giving you some of the common ones here. So for our test purposes and so forth, we'll go by these same charts. And when I give you a quiz on this, I'll tell you exactly what verbs you'll be responsible for, so you'll know whether, you know, their aorist is as first or second aorist. Now, grapho is one that had a first aorist in its active and middle forms, but it's got second aorist in the passive. And it becomes egraphane. Now, you would have expected egraphane if it were a first aorist. You would have had the theta on it. But it doesn't have the theta. And that's your marker for a second aorist. There's no theta there. Still got the same endings, though, eight anew, and all the rest of the endings would be the same as that paradigm. So that's one nice feature of the second aorist, passive. It does have the same endings, but the fate is not there. Philibo becomes ethlibane, and the beta, so you would have expected the beta to have that phonological change and become phi theta again. You would have expected ethlibthane if it were a first aorist, but it's not. So we get ethlibane and no theta there. Copto becomes ecopane, just a P8 anew, no theta there. And crupto becomes ecrubane. We get a base change here from the P tau to a beta. Instead of, your normal expected form for P tau would be phi theta again, but it's not. So there's no way to predict what's going to happen. See, if you were to look at something like crupto, you would expect that to be very regular. I mean, it's got a P tau ending, and it's just like calupto, but it turns out not to end up that way. So we just have to learn them. But fortunately, they're easy to recognize because of these eta type endings. In other words, if you're reading along in the context and you see a form like that, your first thought is not first or second aorist. It's just you know it's an aorist passive. And then you can look and see if there's a theta there or not. Well, if theta's there, it's a first aorist passive. If it's a theta's not there, it's a second aorist passive. So it's really easy to recognize them. Now, it's not easy to predict, though, what it's going to be. You know, if you've got it in English and you're trying to write in Greek, you just have to know what it is. And for a person who speaks Greek, he just grows up learning what it is. So he doesn't probably even stop to think twice about it unless he takes a grammar class and he starts to, you know, put them in paradigms, just like we don't think twice about all the irregularities of the English verbs that we're using every day. And, yes, Jim?
So it seems to me that what they call a first aorist is just the ones that follow the rules and they have a catch factor.
Well, in effect, but you see, there are still irregular first aorists, too. Some of the first aorists don't follow the rules. Because they had a different phonological change or a stem change, but the feature of the first aorist that makes it different from the second aorist is the first aorist has a theta in there, and the second aorist doesn't. And there may be irregularities in both as far as
is
the stem.
Is it generally true, though, that the first aorists tend to be more regular in
there? Oh, I would say yes, on the whole they would be. On the whole they would be. You'd see less phonological changes and so forth as a whole, because anything that's second aorist is probably going to have automatically some irregularity in the base. Anything that's first aorist, you'll have some with irregularities, a majority with no irregularities. So, yeah, I think that would be fair. Mm-hmm.
Does the ending do the same as the first aorist passive?
Right.
Okay, if I get this right, then in the active, the aorist errors for the first aorist, and you have the imperfect endings for the second aorist.
Mm-hmm.
In the middle, you got the aorist endings for the first aorist.
Right.
And the middle end, or the imperfect endings.
Right.
And in the passive, you've got aorist endings for the first aorist and aorist endings for the second aorist.
Right. You got it right. Okay. Okay. Maybe just diagram. Yeah. So this is all aorist now, and let's say active, middle, passive. As far as the ending systems are concerned, now we have let's see, aorist endings versus imperfect endings. Now let's do it this way. Let's say first aorist, first and second. Okay. Now, in the first aorist, active, we would just have our aorist type endings. And that ending system, you know, were just the alpha type endings that we, the first one, the aorist endings we learned. In the second aorist, we had a stem change, and we reverted to imperfect type endings. Imperfect endings for the active. In the middle, the same thing. We had aorist endings for the middle in the first aorist, and we had imperfect endings. We had a stem change plus the imperfect type endings. Now, these aren't the same imperfect endings. Maybe I should make a distinction. Let's say aorist active endings here, imperfect active endings here, aorist middle endings here, and imperfect middle or passive endings here, because they're the same endings for middle and passive. Okay, and then here we have the aorist passive endings, and we have aorist passive endings for the second aorist. In other words, the same ending system. So this departs from the pattern we've seen with the active in the middle. We had active endings here, and then the second aorist had imperfect endings. Active endings here, and the second aorist had imperfect endings. But now in the passive, they both have the same set of endings, aorist passive endings. So, but the only difference has been some sort of stem change, and really no theta
That's the basic thing. That's the most obvious distinction, and that's a consistent one. That's one you can always rely on. If you go only by a stem change, you have irregular first aorists that have stem change too. So that can't be the ultimate criterion.
And this we'll try to resolve too. When I put this grand paradigm on the board, as it were, we'll try to set things up and so forth. We'll make a chart to show how to form each and every one of these. And there's one chart that we've got that will give you all this information in a total picture that works out real well. Okay, any other questions on these forms before we look at meanings of the middle?
I just tried on Jurisco.
Mm-hmm.
There's no augment on there. When it augments, it doesn't change.
Oh, theoretically, I guess there is. The epsilon upsilon, when it takes the augment, doesn't change. Yeah, sometimes it goes to eta upsilon, and other times it doesn't change. So you have to say it's really there, but it's just invisible. Okay? So theoretically, there is an augment there. All right. Section 131, I guess we didn't look at that one yet. It will be noticed that all aorist forms, active, middle, and passive, first or second, have the augment when they are in the indicative mood. All forms so far are in the indicative. Now, when we get to other types of moods, imperative especially, for example, there won't be any augments. Okay, then the meaning of the middle voice. And this is just a summarization now and giving you more detail as to the meanings. The Greek middle voice expresses several meanings, but these are not expressed by any single construction in English. In translating verb forms in the middle voice, therefore, we must be guided by the context. And there's three major categorizations. Now, other more refined textbooks, and if you look at Robertson's and so forth, get into more detail, they may break this down in even further subcategories. So the way that meanings are broken down in grammar books sometimes varies. But we'll just use this as our kind of rough approximation to start with. Number one, the middle voice may express a direct reflexive meaning. That's the one we've already looked at. That is, the subject of a verb in the middle voice may indicate both the performer and the receiver of the action indicated by the verb. This is probably the least common meaning of the middle voice. Least common, but the easiest to see. Okay, that's why he uses the number one. In other words, this is the case where you do something to yourself. A reflexive action in which you're performing the action upon yourself, or someone's performing it upon themselves, and so forth. That's the subject is both the performer and the receiver of the action. So that's the easiest, perhaps, to see, but it's, according to what the statistics are, the least common. Okay, the second meaning is what we call indirect reflexive meaning. Indirect reflexive meaning. In this case, and this may be the most common, you see, either between two and three, I think this is probably the most common. The subject of the verb in the middle voice may indicate both the performer of the action and that to or for which the action is performed. That's the way he words it here, that to or for which the action is performed. That's not always, as we discussed last week, it may not always be the most accurate way to say it. And some textbooks use the idea of interest. Sometimes it's not always interest, because interest often indicates a positive connotation. And it may not always be most of the time. I'm sure the majority of the time it would be a positive connotation. But sometimes a person may do something to himself that may not be to his advantage. And you could still use a middle voice for that. So, it may indicate both the performer of the action and that to or for which the action is performed. It's almost as though, in the first sense here, a direct reflexive. Remember, we've had direct object. You've seen the term direct object. In the first sense, the performer of the action is also the direct object. In the second sense, the performer of the action is almost also the indirect object. That may be a way to think of it. That's why they call it indirect reflexive. In other words, you see, the direct object in our previous analysis was basically that to or for which the action is performed. In other words, the man gave the bone to the dog. Okay, the bone would be the direct object, to the dog would be the indirect object. Now, in other words, the dog was the one to or from which the action of the giving the bone was performed. And in an indirect reflexive idea, using a middle voice, you can gain that same sense if a person does something for himself or to himself, and the thing that he does, you see, is the direct object, and he's the one that's receiving, in somehow, some sense, an indirect effect by the action. That might be the most, neutral way to say it. He's affected by the action. And the effect that is generally an intended one. then we see an indirect reflexive. He's not the one that's directly receiving the action, but he is somehow off to the sides receiving and affected by the action, just like the giving was done to the bone, but the dog was the one that got the benefit of it, you see, in that case. So, when so used, a verb in the middle voice may govern a noun or pronoun in the accusative case, which functions the same way as the direct object of a verb in the active voice. So, in this case, you may see a verb, you may see a subject, a verb in the middle voice, and a direct object. And then, in the sense, in the normal sense. And but the odd thing is that you've got what looks like a passive. You know, in a case, for example, where the verb could be either middle or passive, you can tell it's middle because if there's an accusative direct object there, because now it's got to be middle. If it were a pure passive form, you wouldn't have a direct object like that in the accusative case. You would rather have an agent stated with the genitive, or that phrase hupo plus the genitive. So. We'll have to piece this together, and as we look at examples, keep drawing attention to this. But indirect reflexive, it's a very common sense of it. And this is why a lot of the translations render it something like, for his own interest or self-interest or something like this. But I think it's the best way to do it is recognize that you've got a middle form and then look at the context to see what the implications of that are and pick a translation that's appropriate there. Yes?
What do you suppose if they didn't have separate forms for the present and the imperfect in this?
That's a real good question. It's the same thing that you wonder why they make a distinction in the aorist between progressive action and indefinite action, but they don't make any distinction in the present or in the imperfect. And I suppose that part of it, and this is only a guess, but part of it is that when you're dealing with narrative and so forth, when you're almost always dealing with the past tense. I think most, in any kind of written form, this type of thing, you're seldom using the present tense forms or the imperfect forms either. I think you're most often you're using aorist forms, and because the aorist form is carrying the biggest load as far as how often things are used, that may be where they're focusing the refinements and this type of thing. That's just a guess. I don't know if it's valid or not, but I know that you'll find that if you go through like something like the New Testament and you're recording in the Gospels, historical events, you're generally going to be seeing the aorist used. You'll see imperfects and you'll see presence if a quotation and so forth and this type of thing, but most often it's going to be your aorist. And then, of course, in Hebrew narrative, the same kind of thing happens. Your perfect forms, or at least forms that have perfect meaning, are going to be your most common forms. And there may be some other observations to that, too, but all we know is this is the way it is, and for sure. And I suppose, I don't know, though, that the context, you might say it may be easier from the context to tell for present and imperfect forms, but I don't think that would necessarily hold up. Because contexts in the aorist should be about the same as those in present and imperfect as far as those distinctions are concerned, whether you've got a direct object or not, this type of thing. Okay, it would seem to me most likely it would have something to do with the fact that the aorist forms are used so frequently. But then again, you have another problem because the future forms are also have a distinction and the future forms aren't used that frequently at all. So that may blow the theory right there. I don't know. Okay. I've never heard any, but I've never seen anything written, speculating on why that's the case. Number three, the third meaning that you may see is the middle voice may express a causative meaning. Causative meaning. Hebrew has a way to do this too with another conjugation. But in this case, the subject of the verb in the middle voice may indicate the person who causes or allows an action to be performed. So he may not be the direct performer of the action, but he may be one who is somehow causing or allowing this action to be performed. And so in some sense he is involved in the performing of the action, but not directly. And a middle voice may also be used to express this kind of meaning. An indirect, a causative meaning. In other words, he's not directly performing the action, but he's somehow involved in the performance of that action. And usually that action has it has something to do with himself too, something in either his own interest or affecting him somehow. So in other words, again, you're seeing somehow the performer of the action is also, he may not be directly performing it, but he's involved in the performance and the receiving the action some way. So you'll see that he'll give some examples here that maybe illustrate that. Using the same verb here, anoint, and many examples. We'll see the range of meanings here. Eleipsa auton, I anointed him. Okay, there you'd just be an active voice form, subject, verb, object, as we've normally seen. Eleipsa tain kephalensu, I anointed your head. So again, same thing. just your subject, verb, object, active sentence structure. Now in the middle voice, we have several possible meanings here. We have eleipsa main, just by itself, which could mean, without any more context, it could mean I anointed myself, a direct reflexive action. Or it might mean I had myself or let myself be anointed. There's your causative action. So it might mean I allowed myself to be anointed. So again, he would be not performing the action. Someone else would be performing it, but he had some decisions to make. He had some sort of input into whether or not the action was going to be performed on him. So you can see the idea of a middle involved in that, because he is both involved in the initiation of the action, even though he may not be performing it, and in the receiving of the action. And how would you know if you saw just a eleipsa main, whether it should be translated I anointed myself or I had myself anointed? Context alone would be your guide on that particular distinction. Yes?
Any way to say that specifically, I had myself anointed or I let myself be anointed?
Well, yes, so there is another system. There's a word for to allow or to let and so forth. And we'll be examining that later on. Then they can use an infinitive form with that verb. A lot like English. English uses a lot of combinations with an auxiliary verb and an infinitive. The Greek will do that in some cases. And I think in this case you could set it up that way.
The only way to do it in the indicative is like this.
Right, in the indicative, the only way to do it would be like this, to
use the context
plus a middle voice form. And this is probably what you'd see most frequently. But there is if there's going to be a real potential ambiguity, in other words, if there's not enough context to really show, they may use a different system and use an infinitive form with an auxiliary type of verb. There's a certain type of what we might call causative verbs that will set up structures like that, just very much like English does. Okay, and then if you have a middle voice form with a direct object, eleipsamein, tain kephalein mu, I had my head anointed, or I let my head be anointed, would be a causative sense that you would see there. Or the first one, I guess I skipped the first one, I anointed my head. That would be indirect reflexive. You see, you didn't anoint yourself, but you anointed your head. And so what's happening there is that you are doing an anointing, and since it's your head that's being anointed, it's two or four you that the action is being performed, so a middle voice would be used there, even though you have a direct object here, tain kephalein. And then, of course, the context would have to decide this, but it might be I had my head anointed. In other words, if it's obvious that somebody else did it and you didn't do it, then, but you were the one that gave permission for it to be done, then that might be the translation there. Okay, and then the passive voice would just be a leif fain hupo tu mathe tu mu, just applying a theoretical agent. I was anointed by my disciple. In other words, he puts "by my disciple" in brackets because you don't always need that as a necessary constituent of a passive sentence. You may not have the agent expressed, but it's still clearly a passive construction. Okay, and then, is the bell rung? Okay, for tomorrow then, go ahead and look at exercises 17. They're short, but good, yeah. So there's 17 A, B, C, and D, and E. Okay, we'll go through the whole works tomorrow if we've got the time. And lots of ways to make mistakes on these, so we want to really spend some time with it and pay careful and close attention to it. So if you have questions, they should be manifest by the time we get through that. Okay, that's all. Yes?
On this, you look back at the first time I saw the arrows, the meanings.
Yes.
Explicitly indicative, imperfect.
Well, it's not just was, it's was with the ing ending. We form the passive by using the auxiliary verb. We form the progressive action by using the auxiliary verb. We form the passive by doing the same thing. So we have to look at both the verb.